Hi, today on Spiritual Not Religious, I am interviewing Jane Colton. She is a licensed clinical social worker by profession and just a generally super amazing, cool person by, doesn't even have to do that professionally. She's just doing that for free. And I was, I got to talk to her today about a lot of things, among which her particular style of movement therapy that she developed, and that she offers group workshops in a process using movement to change. I'll let her talk about it instead of me trying to explain it. But she, do take a listen. Interview pops right into kind of mid-sentence, so don't be alarmed. You're not missing your podcast has not malfunctioned. The recording kind of comes in sort of mid-sentence. So, right after this, important announcement, take a listen to my cool and fun conversation with Jane Colton. I just want to make sure that everybody knows this is something you're definitely going to want to check out if you can find a spot in her workshop, and if not, try to get in one future. So tell me about what is the movement therapy process that you created? And I only just found out today. I've been really interested in it as a process and wanting to interview you about it. But I didn't know until just today that this is something that you and colleagues developed. Like, this isn't something you got trained by somebody else to do. This is like something that you specifically developed. So tell me, first of all, what is it? And then we'll talk more about your process of developing it.
Yes, it is. It's something, it's like innate. It was innate in me and it just simply came out. I had the opportunity to design a healing process, so to speak, at a workshop on Whidbey Island when I lived in Seattle. And what came out was the process of me moving my life story. There were no words involved. I used some music, but it was like, I think it was pretty much from in utero to my present age at that time. It was in the early 90s. And it was just simply a embodiment. Like, I let my body inform me of the feelings, the emotions that I had growing up in some pretty severe dysfunction. That's how I grew up. And I really no longer have shame about that. Mm-hmm. That's just the way I grew up. So that's where it came mm-hmm. from. So I would say that then it's a gift to me to have grown up the way that I grew up.
Cool. So first off, if you don't mind me rabbit holing a little bit, isn't that fascinating that we carry shame about dysfunction over which we had no control?
It is. It is. I want to say unfortunate, but I don't know. I'm not sure what's fortunate.
It's a thing.
Yeah. Yeah. It's, it informs us. Probably to a point where it's time to change this information. This information is not serving me well to think that there's something wrong with me or that I'm unlovable. That does not serve me or anybody around me. So it starts out with these bad, I want to say voices.
I know what you mean. No, we all have what I call loud self-talk.
Yeah, loud self-talk.
Anybody out there that's in denial about that, just sit in a quiet room for 5 minutes.
For sure. So it starts out pretty unkind, the messages that I pick up in childhood. I have no choice here. I'm in this weird situation. But as I mature, as I grow up and become an adult, now I've got a choice. At some point, they start screaming so loud, it's like, oh no, I'm done listening to you. And they don't just magically disappear. There's all kinds of processes that you can go through. I love movement.
Yeah. So, and I want to get into that more in just a second, but I want to also follow up asking you now, since a person who, one of the many things I really respect about you is that you are a therapist who has done your own work. Don't get me started on therapists who don't do their own work, because I get really ranty and boring about it. But you have. And so with that in mind, as both a professional and a teacher and helper to others, and also in your own work, why do we, like, I'm just revisiting that. Like, why is there shame? Why is that the way we humans all across the board react to stuff that happened to us over which we had no control?
I think my take on it is that as a child, we're completely powerless. We've got no power. There's these large people doing what they do, maybe saying the exact words that, you know, you're doing it wrong, you're stupid, you're whatever it is that that they say, and we're powerless. So it follows then, in my way of thinking, that now I'm wrong and bad. I am wrong and bad. I'm shamed and shameful. That feeling that there's something wrong with me brings shame. Mm-hmm. You know, that feeling that I should be different than I am and I'm not doing it right breeds shame. Mm-hmm.
And I think, you know, if I'm just, it's just dawning on me, also, maybe it almost in that state feels more awful to acknowledge the powerlessness than it is to be willing to temporarily adopt shame, because in the truth, because what we really are doing in those situations by taking on a belief in shame is we are trying to take power back, because we're basically, by saying this is my fault, I'm saying I have control.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah, that makes sense.
Yeah, yeah. I'm saying I have control. And so maybe the impulse, so it's like, you know, of course, there's a naivete associated with it because you're a child and there's a whole bunch of different things like that. But I'm also thinking about it in the perspective of that we are more than just random organisms that get born, right? We are infinite souls that sometimes are in varying stages of naivete based on whatever, right?
Yeah.
Anyway, so from that perspective, there, I think there's something, some bigger impulse there. Anyway, just something that just popped into my head. So now, why movement? Why do you feel like, you said just in utero, that's just innate in you? Why do you think that is?
Maybe you've heard of Dr. Candace Pert. I can't remember her school or where she was, but she studied, researched cellular memory.
Okay, and I haven't heard of her. So where and what, tell me a little bit more about her. She studied cellular memory.
Yes, she did a really wonderful scientific research program. And it's funny because she was in a movie, a documentary called What the Bleep Do We Know?
Oh, that's one of my favorite movies.
Yeah,
I love that movie.
I love that movie too. And she was in that, in the documentary part of that.
Mm-hmm.
I think I jotted some notes here. I can't remember where she did her research.
That's no worries. Don't worry about it. Yeah.
But in that movie, if you go back and watch that again, she can show you exactly how people get addicted to emotions just as much as they get addicted to substances.
Interesting.
And because there's a reward system.
Sure.
And even if it's a negative emotion, that reward system kicks in.
Sure.
So I'm so used to being mad. Mad's my go-to emotion. So now I'm addicted to the anger, sad, or whatever it is. So she is one of the people in the forefront of cellular memory. It has, however, been studied by, there was a study at Southwestern, Candace Pert wrote a book called Molecules of Emotion, The Science Behind Mind-Body Medicine. But there was another study done in Texas that showed that there is scientific proof that our bodies hold memory.
Mm-hmm.
Our bodies hold memory.
Yeah.
And that getting access to that information enhances the ability to heal or to become our best self or our bigger self.
Yeah.
To have expansion in our lives, to become more conscious, to become part of the bigger picture, which is pretty exciting.
That is exciting.
to come from a child who felt so powerless and so beat up, and to be where I am now, you know, it's incredible. I'm so grateful for the people that I've learned from and for having the wherewithal to say, I need help, and getting that help.
Yeah, and mystically, you know, one of the things that there's a whole bunch of reasons why I am annoyed by therapists who don't do their own work, their own, you know, personal growth work. But what's especially sad about it is that I think that is the gift of it. That's the gift of challenges in our lives, is that when we heal it, then we have a path to help other people heal. We can take them down that path.
Exactly. And that's my motivation for becoming a clinical social worker. It's like, if I can go through the transitions, and yeah, it's taken a while, but if I can go through those transitions and create the life that I have today, you know, I'm grateful. I'm so grateful. The other part of that is that I will never ask a client to do something that I'm not willing to do myself.
Mm-hmm. Right. And furthermore, I think we can, because like I've seen clinicians who haven't done any deep work. And if they see someone else do deep work, it causes the clinician to feel all panicky. Right? Like the clinician themselves has never allowed themselves to feel deeply. And so if a client is feeling deeply, some of the clinicians will want to like rescue and enable real quick, because the therapist is like, no, that's dangerous. I don't know what's in there.
I'm uncomfortable. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But if you yourself have gone into those labyrinths and, you know, went spelunking around in your consciousness, and you see someone else do it, you know, oh yeah, you
can,
you know, it's exciting. It's still unpleasant, and it is a little, it is scary, but it isn't something that you go in and try to rescue, because then you're rescuing people from getting healing.
Yes.
Don't go in there. There's monsters, and I don't, you know.
And then we shut down the healing process.
We do, so I get opinionated about that. So,
it's like John Bradshaw said all those decades ago, you know, the only way out is through. Mm-hmm. You just can't go around it. You can't act like it's not there. Mm-hmm. So yeah, there's pain involved in healing and reclaiming your life, reclaiming your voice. Mm-hmm. You know, kids that grow up in a dysfunctional situation are told to sit down, shut up, don't make noise, don't draw attention to yourself. So it shuts down air, like we were talking about, the power of the child. It just diminishes everything. I'm not supposed to talk, so I can't express myself. You know, I'm not supposed to be seen. So I start holding my body. It's sort of like that body armoring, you know, that when something hurts us, now we get a tough outer skin.
Right.
So, it's sad when people grow up in dysfunctional situations, and it's amazing, happy, celebratory when people walk through it. There's a reward for going through that pain.
Oh, heck yeah. Yeah. And it is, it's what that whole process is, like what I call, you know, turning poop into gold, is because it's like, because it is taking something that could, or like, you know, I'm turning the nicer version is turning poison into medicine.
Yeah.
Taking something that will kill you and turning into something that heals you. But I like to say it is definitely not like turning lemons into lemonade, because lemons really aren't that bad and lemonade isn't really that good.
I love that. That's great. That's so true.
But it's really about taking something that will kill you and turning it into something that not only heals you, but that, I mean, it heals everybody.
Yes, everybody. There's no healing in one person that doesn't affect everybody outside.
Isn't that neat?
It's so cool. That's what I love about being part of humanity. Mm-hmm. We can't separate ourselves from humanity. We can try for all we're worth. Mm-hmm. This is funny to me, but I'll have clients that come in and they go, I hate people. And I go, I know, we're disgusting.
They're the worst.
Yeah, we are disgusting.
We are the worst. Exactly.
Yeah, because it's that separation that kills us. It kills us. The other thing that kills us is the toxicity in the cells of our body. Mm. That, literally, that's what the study done in Texas was about, is that the cellular memory, if it is traumatic, it's toxic and it causes disease. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. It causes disease in your body. Mm-hmm. So if you have an opportunity to detox your body through movement, do it.
I agree. So it sounds like, let me know if I have this right, but it sounds like this process came to you sort of through an inspiration.
Yes, I'd agree with that.
So tell me about that process. Like, because I think a lot of us have inspirations, but we don't always take action in them. So talk a little bit about that whole process of coming to this insight of this thing and then developing it and all of that.
That's an interesting question. Just sort of as a preface to that, I remember as a young adult loving to dance. I love to dance. I like to go out and dance. Mm-hmm. And what I realized later was that it was the movement that was expressing my inner state. It's like, to me, all dance is not pretty. I love the dance that expresses the anger or the angst or the sadness. All of that. I love that movement that says, this is how I feel. And it's angular and maybe discordant, chaotic.
Right.
Because you dance it out of your body. You dance it right out of your body. My experience of that is moving in those ways and having those memories like dissipate. They just kind of bubble up and bubble on out.
Hmm.
So there's less of the story, which is so good.
Yeah.
The story keeps us stuck.
Because the story is that the experience is trapped is in the body, but the story, I think, is in the cerebral cortex.
Absolutely. And it's probably not even true, not the way your cortex is.
Exactly.
Interpreting.
It's real, but it isn't true.
Exactly. Did those things happen? Yes.
Did stuff happen that is real?
Stuff, yes.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Was it the story? it doesn't even matter if it was the story.
It doesn't.
Because the real, because it was real, but it wasn't true.
Yes. You know, one of the therapeutic techniques I use is narrative therapy, which is all about rewriting your story.
Yeah.
The brain believes what it wants to believe. It loves stories.
Yeah.
And it will take any story you tell it as the absolute truth.
Yeah, that's a lovely way to say it. And exactly. Mm-hmm.
So if I'm telling myself a story that hurts me, and if I'm telling it over and over and how I was a victim, and as a child, I was a victim.
And that's what was real.
Yes, and that was real. I am no longer a victim. I haven't been a victim for a long time. And being a victim, I say there's a reason that the word ick is in the middle of victim. Because it feels awful.
Because it feels yucky.
Yeah, it feels terrible. So stepping out of that, as soon as anybody realizes that they've been abused, that they've been intimidated, and bad things have happened to them, as soon as you realize that, it's like, okay, I get to do something about this. My parents can't. They can't. Nobody can do it except me, with help, with support. I've come a long way. I show up, and then I ask for help, and I get this wonderful support from therapists, from friends, from workshops, from wherever it comes from. You know, these epiphanies, these things that like just dawn on me. It's like, wow. So when I open up to healing, it's like when the student's ready, the teacher appears.
Ah, right. Right. And in the idea that both the student in that analogy, both the teacher and the student are in you.
True.
That's I mean, there are other places also, but when you were saying that when the student is ready, the teacher appears, I was thinking in a sense, like when you're willing to gather insight comes through you.
Yes.
Or to you, or however it doesn't, you know. So I was just saying like, it's that, it also, we have teachers and students outside of our physical bodies as well. But I mean, in that sense, I just saw it as like, as soon as you're ready to hear wisdom, you have wisdom.
Yes, I agree with that. Yeah, I think the first place I really learned that was in a study group for A Course in Miracles.
Mm-hmm.
That we're all students, we're all teachers.
Mm-hmm.
And how wonderful is that? It's wonderful. I can learn from anybody. One of my favorite memories is talking to a five-year-old. And she said, well, what do you want to be? You know, what do you want to be? What do you want to do? I said,
the five-year-old was asking.
Yes, she asked me.
Okay.
And I said, I want to make the world a more beautiful place. And she said, well, who doesn't? Who doesn't want that job? I love that perspective. It was just a natural thing to her. Of course you want to make the world a more beautiful place.
And you probably want lunch later too. So with you, no, I'm just kidding. Yeah. From her perspective, that is beautiful. So, say about what we want to create. Oh yeah. So you mentioned A Course in Miracles, and I've been studying that recently. I've been doing the workbook exercises and reading the book, and it's really challenging. It's really challenging, which is great. I would say, but you mentioned about teachers and students. You know, early on in the text portion, it is said that the only way to learn is to teach. It doesn't say the best way or a good way or a cute way. It says the only way. And I think, you know, so then I think, well, that might be why I stepped into somewhat of a teaching role. It's why I probably just was really wanting to dig my heels into learning.
Yeah, I absolutely, absolutely agree with that. You know, the teacher learns the most.
Mm-hmm.
And there's another Dianetics or Scientology. Mm-hmm. One of the things that I did like about Scientology mm-hmm. is that concept of unless you can demonstrate it, you don't know it. Unless you can explain it, you don't know it. Mm-hmm. Like we think we know it, we hear something, oh yeah, I know that. But it's not fully developed until you can give it to someone else.
Right, and that's also in A Course of Miracles, and in Nichiren Buddhism, one of the things that they talk about is different kinds of proof, and the highest proof is actual proof. Meaning, it's same thing. It's like there's theoretical proof. And there's this kind of proof, and you know, basically, like there's all these different kinds of proofs, but the most important proof is actual proof. Meaning, did something change?
Yes, I like this this term also, based on results.
Mm-hmm.
Based on results, so you can ask someone, "How did you do?" And they'll say whatever they say, or they'll say, "I don't know." And you can always go to based on results. How did it go?
Right, which is a great standard of measurement. And it's funny, I think why that's sometimes hard is that sometimes people have a hard time on the upfront defining what results they're even seeking.
Yeah, true.
Typically, I think more often than not, speaking for myself, and maybe I would assume I'm a lot like all the humans, so I'm gonna guess it's a human thing. Mostly, what I'm really seeking in any situation is to get out of discomfort.
Yes, absolutely. I was talking to someone that was at one time addicted to meth.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, I wasn't addicted to meth, I was addicted to feeling better.
Duh!
Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah.
That's why, and I, when I worked with folks in addiction recovery, some people will say, okay, you guys, this is gonna be awkward, because I don't know if any of you guys realize this, but one of the main reasons why people become addicted is because drugs feel really good at first.
Yes.
And I say that too, you know, and they laugh because it's one of those things. I like to say that most obvious things in the whole wide world as if they are revelatory, because that's funny to me.
Yeah, but at the same time.
And also true.
Yeah.
And I think what's funny to me about it is that that's what we do get so out of touch with the most obvious things in the whole wide world. Like, you know, why do people get addicted? Because, well, one of the reasons is because drugs are addictive.
Yeah,
I mean, that's
part of it.
That is part of it. But you know, primarily, I would guess it's to get out of pain. The difference is that we're all trying to get out of pain. But if you try to get out of pain by exercising a lot, you'll get a little bit addicted, but you ain't gonna get heroin addicted.
That's true. Yeah. Yes, absolutely. Some addictions are better than others.
Well, the way I always say it is everybody's an addict. We just want to clear up the ones that'll kill you the fastest.
Yes.
First. Yeah. Try to get off the addictions that'll kill you the fastest. And then accept the fact that you might get really obsessed with tidying your underwear drawer.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay, I want to say something about, you know, drugs feel good at first, because this is self-revelation, but I have 31 years of sobriety.
Yay! So cool. Congratulations.
And I will never forget my first drink. I will never forget it. Mm-hmm. I was 18 years old. I just graduated from high school. I was at this backyard swimming pool party. It was in a very lovely home. They were all drinking daiquiris, and they said, "You want one?" And I was like, "No, I don't drink." And about the third time that they asked me, I said, "Okay, well, make me one, but make it really weak." And so anyway, they brought me this daiquiri, and I remember taking a drink of that drink, maybe two or three, and just for the first time in my life, my muscles relaxed for the first time in 18 years of life.
Wow.
Tell me that didn't feel good.
Yeah, exactly.
So, of course, I was like, well, I found the answer.
Yeah. No. And all of these nice people at the nice house are doing it.
Yeah. Yeah. So it works for some people, I guess, you know. Did not work for me, and it doesn't work for a lot of people because it mm-hmm. becomes the only thing that you can go to.
Yep.
And there's some damage, physical.
Sure.
Physical damage that occurs in brain and body and relationships and all of that. So yeah, there's a way out of that too.
Yeah. So Jane, thank you so much for being here today.
Well, I'm really excited to be here, Tracy. Thank you for inviting me.
Yay! So excited. So tell me about, so first off, movement therapy, before we move any farther along, when is your next workshop?
My next workshop is in October, October 12th. I really don't do workshops in the summer because everybody's busy with their summer activities. So nobody wants to spend 6 hours inside.
Okay. So October, about when? And you said
The 12th.
The 12th.
On a Saturday.
On a Saturday. Okay, cool. So, and we'll talk more about where the location for this is. Okay, we will be right back with more with my interview with Jane Colton. You feel so powerfully about seeing other people change because of the changes that you yourself have gone through, and you were saying that you don't make them change.
Yes, because this is the deal. If somebody reaches that point where it's like they reach out, and I honor anybody that comes and sits on the couch. Mm-hmm. You know, there's maybe a stigma in society, well, you're weak if you need help, and that's so
untrue. Can we get over that already? Because I'm kind of bored with that one.
Yeah.
I'm bored with that particular stigma.
Yes.
Let's move on to something more interesting.
Like the courage that it takes to say, I need help. It's a courageous act to come in.
And it shouldn't even have to freaking be courageous. No, it should be the most natural thing in the whole wide world.
Absolutely. And so when somebody comes in, you know, if we're going to make progress, I look at it like sort of like a road trip. The mm-hmm. therapist and the client, we're on a road trip. Sometimes I drive, mm-hmm. sometimes they drive.
Ah, I love it.
Yeah. And, you know, people that have this idea that you go sit in the therapist's office and just sit there and let them fix you, it's not going to happen. Mm-mm. It's not going to happen. Mm-mm. So the therapist gets to bring it, the client gets to bring it, and we go together. We go together. So I can't fix anybody. Mm-hmm. I am not responsible for the
And they're not even broken.
They're not broken, right. I can't fix them, and I don't get to take credit when somebody has fantastic
results.
Because they do the work. I facilitate, I help with perspective. Mm-hmm. I have all kinds of ideas about things, movement mm-hmm. therapy.
Yeah.
And so I support their healing.
Sure.
I don't make
You hold space for it.
Yes,
you
absolutely.
Hold space for it. And, you know, it's a balance, isn't it? Mm-hmm. Between getting out of their way and just holding space and providing intervention, or, you know, providing like, you know, I tend to work really fast with people, and I usually level set early on. It's like, cause I work more, and I kind of like look at the person, and I can kind of see a lot of stuff. And then I follow my internal guidance about, will this be relevant? But then I also check, okay, you know, and I'll say, okay, you know, I'm noticing some stuff. Let me know if I'm going, you know, but more often than not, I just listen to my inner guidance, and I say, is this too much for them right now, or should I go?
I get that, yes.
Yeah.
I agree with that. To refrain from saying something just because I'm noticing it.
Exactly, because then it's just parlor tricks.
Yeah.
That's what I, you know what I mean? It's like, watch me pull a rabbit out of a hat. You know, look at what I can do. I can, you know, and that's really, I'd say that used to be a lot more tempting when I was younger.
Yeah, yeah. It's a natural human characteristic. Somebody is in pain or hurting or, you know, many people come to therapy for advice, you know, and I say, I don't give advice, you know, because the answers are in you anyway.
Right.
And that allowing that silence, when the client talks and they quit talking, there's so much power in that moment of silence.
Yeah.
Instead of filling it up with ideas and this and that and overwhelming a client.
Right.
That moment of silence is so important because that's processing time.
I know. And I do. I notice I want to sometimes, I have to like really let them do their thing. But what I do once what I will do, and I think there's two purposes for this, where I will after a little while say, what are you noticing?
That's a great question.
Yeah. Or what's coming up for you right now? Because, you know, so I'm waiting. I'm trying not to like, interfere with their work that they're doing. But at the same time, I think it can be useful to what are you noticing, because it helps them to get a grip on it. Like grab it, have a to anchor it.
Yes.
And as opposed to just letting it continue to go back into subconscious stuff.
Yes, yes. And to take that question one step further, where are you feeling that in your body?
Yeah.
Where are you feeling that in your body? Because growing up in a traumatic, abusive situation, I don't remember most of it, to tell you the truth.
Sure.
It's that dissociative state that protects at the time.
Sure.
And so having pushed that away or went away so I could survive, it's like, that's why I'm so excited to find cellular memory. Mm. It's there. The memories are there. And I don't need to go into detail again. I don't need to go to that horrible,
horrible
place. Because the body can clear itself, given the opportunity. So where do I feel it in my body? There's a start. Okay, there's a start on movement therapy. Mm-hmm. Well, move that part. What happens when you move that part? It's so exciting because you can see relief come over people.
I love that. So when you were developing it initially, it sounds like you were, were you developing it to meet a need for a workshop, or did you develop to heal it specifically for yourself, and then you extended it to a workshop?
It was absolutely personal at the time. Mm-hmm. I was moving out of the results of trauma. I was moving out of that, and so it was absolutely personal. And because it was so powerful for me, it just became a go-to.
It's so cool. Did you feel nervous about presenting it to clients? Because I'm speaking for myself. Like sometimes, because I do some, I work in a lot of different kinds of ways, and some of them are a little bit more conventional and some not so much, right? And I get a lot of pushback from myself about that, about fear of being too weird.
I love weird.
Oh, I love it too on my Facebook memes. But in reality, sometimes it can be really
hard. Yeah, in a profession where many, many people, you know,
yeah.
If it's not in the book, it's, you know, you don't go there. There's so many healing techniques that aren't in a book.
Oh, exactly. And you know how things become evidence-based? By doing them long enough to get some evidence. I love when people say, that's not evidence-based. Oh, I forgot that all the evidence-based practices came down from the mountain with Moses. That was on the third tablet. It was cognitive behavior therapy. And it was on the third tablet.
That's funny.
Yeah. Anyway, sorry. So, but back to when you started to present that to clients, like in a context of like a group, in the context of group work, did you have any pushback from yourself or resistance about doing something that wasn't, you know, cognitive behavior therapy?
Absolutely. Absolutely. You know, it was like, because I developed it, it's like, I don't have a handbook. I don't have a, let me check, you know, how these other people did this.
Mm-hmm.
It's one of those things that it's there. Okay. Now what do I do with it? And, is it going to be accepted? You know, that for a long time, I was like, well, I don't think this is going to be accepted. Well, now there's proof, you know, now there's scientific proof. In the early 90s, not so much. But it's like the courage to go into recovery or the courage to go to grad school at age 55. Yeah. Or the courage to change your diet or change your habits. It's courage, you know, and I know what it has done for me. Mm-hmm. So there's my proof.
Yeah.
There's my proof. And it took me a long time to actually get it to the workshop phase. Self-doubt, I believe, is in all of us until we tell it to shut up.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
And to just go ahead, just go. So the first workshop, I seemed like I ran into obstacle after obstacle. It's just, you know, I can't find a place or this or that. And that was all of that self-doubt coming.
Sure.
And so every time that happened, I would just simply find a way to do it without that venue. I went to another place. Whatever I had to overcome to get the workshop done, I was doing it. It was time. And of course, the first workshop, I was like really scared. I was scared, and it was so beautiful. Oh my God, Tracy, the movement pieces that these women did. You know, if it wasn't such a beautiful, healing, personal thing, to make a video would be amazing. You know, I will never do that. That's
right.
Not what it is. It's not a performance.
Right.
It is genuine, authentic expression, and it's beautiful.
That is so cool. And one thing that about the issue of the thing of dance. I happened to be at a conference in Florida, and I was staying at a hotel, and it was near like a place where there were some public spaces, and there was a band playing, and there were a lot of people there. So it was in Orlando, and everything is like a Disney thing there. And so it was like some kind of a Disney themed place of some sort. But anyway, there was a band playing, and then there were a bunch of people listening, but nobody was even tapping their toe.
I know, that happens in Idaho.
No, I know. I'm just saying that not like that's a Florida thing. I was not suggesting it was a Florida thing by any stretch, but I was just saying it was a context that was not a bar.
Mm-hmm.
It was not it could have been anywhere, but it was a particular experience where it just really like hurt my heart.
Yes.
And there were like some little kids. Oh, it's really hurting my heart, honestly.
Yeah.
There were some little kids that were dancing because it was still okay.
Yes. Yes.
For them. But I was looking around at all these people who were willing to enjoy the music well enough to sit and listen to it. But it was like pop songs. I mean, it was like, you know, so that the Orlando factor of it is like everything is highly packaged. Everything's very highly packaged. So it was very well, you know, it wasn't like, you know, amateur musicians. It was, you know, fun, peppy pop music with a beat. It was not esoteric. It was not intellectual music. And it wasn't Brian Eno. You know, it wasn't thinky kind of music. And I just thought, what? Why don't we dance?
Yes.
Sorry.
No.
You know, it's just, you know, it's like something's got to change that's so fundamental. And if the only place that we still allow ourselves to dance a little bit is in primitive mating environments, then we're missing out.
We have done ourselves a disservice.
So what can we do to fix that, Jane? And I'm sincere.
Well, I wish I had the answer readily available.
That's so funny you should ask, Tracy. I have a trifled flair about that.
The answer to. And, you know, the fact of the matter is our society is a little different because dance has been part of humanity forever.
Sure.
Haka, African dance.
Sure.
The Scottish. I mean, this has been a part of
Hoedowns and barn raisings here. So I think if we went to Germany or probably even like urban areas in African countries or things like that, we might see a little bit of a similar phenomena because I think it might be in the consciousness. It's like a tipping point, and we have to tip it.
Yes. The flash mobs that come up, does that just like, woo, throughout my body. It wakes up, you know, when people just start dancing. My body responds to music.
Mine does too.
Can't not respond.
Ditto.
Now, whether I get up and get on a dance floor is a different question, but...
Be the change, man.
Exactly. That's the answer.
That's the answer.
When your body is responding to the music, just go ahead, stand up. I think we take ourselves pretty, you know, we take ourselves like, I need to be a certain way in society. And it takes courage, again, to just say, you know what? I want to dance. I want to dance right here, right now. And so I'm going to, you know, and I don't think I've ever seen anybody that got up and danced. I don't think the response to that has been bad.
There wasn't witch burning involved.
Yeah, there was no witch burning.
Oh, this is awkward for us right now. We don't really have time for witch burning, but we're going to have to make time because we got some renegade dancing going on.
Yeah, exactly. So overcoming people's judgment of it.
You know, overcoming our fear of their judgment.
Our fear of their judgment.
And their judgment is based on their own fear and their own fear of being judged.
Yes.
And being weird and different. And it's a be the change thing. Mm-hmm. And I think that before I had kids, I did not give a flying, you know what, people thought, but as soon as I had kids, I started to not want to negatively impact them. And I kind of like, you know, by being weird. So I like hit a lot of, you know, I stopped letting my freak flag fly and kind of hid it in the freak flag suitcase under the bed. And, and so I got out of the habit. I don't regret that. That was a choice. It wasn't the only kind of choice I could have made, but it is what it is. And now that they're older, I think it's just time for me to get back to being able to be the guy that stands up and doesn't care and is dancing.
Absolutely. Go ahead and embarrass your kids.
Well, at this point,
yeah,
they can. And I have, you know, this is the irony, even despite all that, I still managed to embarrass them.
Yeah, we're going to no matter what, so.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. I don't know why, but this just made me think of, there was a drumming group in Seattle when I lived there called Ladies Don't Drum.
Sweet.
And they were amazing. They were amazing.
She says, rubbing her imaginary beard.
Yes, yes. You know, I didn't buy a djembe, so, you know. But Ladies Don't Drum. Oha. Yes,
right.
They do.
That's right. No, I
moms
get it.
Moms don't dance.
Moms.
Yes, they do.
Yeah. Well, there's, I don't regret having made that choice. It was an instinctive choice that I started acting way more normal when the kids were born. or whatever that is, right? Drawing a little bit less attention to myself. But I always had planned to pick that one back up. I kind of just forgot. So I'm just blah, blah, blah. And I'm not advocating for all of you also weird people out there that may be listening that we have to hide our weirdnesses because we have kids. I haven't completely navigated what all of that was about for me. So I'm not suggesting that's what we need to do, but we need to, so women don't drum, this idea of something. So let's set that, even though it may be vague, out as an intention.
Yes.
To help shift that somehow.
Yes, yes. Absolutely. It's like the thought that comes, like, I'm going to get up and do this thing, or I'm going to rearrange that, or I'm going to rearrange my whole house, or I'm going to, whatever it is, that thought, that creative thought that comes, because they do, instead of going, oh, no, that's too hard, oh, that's going to cost money, or that's going to, the things that shut us down. Stick with the thought. How exciting is this going to be when my room looks entirely different? When my body looks different, or my body moves the way that it moves. How exciting is that? Two of my favorite words, expansion, because I think that's what we're doing.
Right.
Expanding and becoming more conscious and part of the bigger picture.
Right.
That is so much fun. It's so much fun to see myself in a different light.
Ah, that's so cool. Well, I know that you have another obligation. So we'll wrap up this portion of the interview today. But what I would love, there's so many different topics, honestly, that I would love to talk to you about. But I'd love to, among the many, many different things, I would love to hear your insights from your experience of working with A Course in Miracles. I think a lot of people would be really, and for a future interview, if you'd be willing to do this again.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
And then also, I'd be also very interested in, I think a lot of people would be really interested in what your experience was in interacting with Scientology.
Uh-huh. Yeah. Yeah.
Because that's another interesting thing. And like almost everything, it sounds like, from what I understand, it's kind of a mixed bag.
It is, yeah.
But I as soon as I find a religion that's not a mixed bag, I will immediately join. all right. Well,
I want to say this.
Yes, please.
For future reference, and when movement workshops are coming up, those kinds of things. I also do a meditation it's on hiatus for the summer, but that will start again in October. But JaneColton.com.
JaneColton.com. So JaneColton.
Yes.
.com.
Yes. Yeah. And there's a place in there that says upcoming events. And a lot of explanation about other technologies that I use in my practice.
Yeah. And I think it is especially exciting that you are the developer of this particular modality. It's always exciting to be working with founders of modalities. So
Yeah, and then what's the venue for the movement workshop that you'll have in October? Do you know?
Yes, I have been having the workshop at Broadway Dance Center in Southeast Boise.
Excellent.
Yeah, it's a big room. It's old and it's lovely.
Fantastic. I wonder if that might be, because I'm in my mind's going like drumming circle venues. A thing like that. So I've been kind of, I don't even have a drum, but I've been having lately an impulse to get a drum and to be in a drumming circle and all of those things. And so I think that's also part of the dancing and all of the things. And like, nobody's teaching, like, for instance, traditional African dance now.
Not right now. I have taken a lot of African dance here in
Can
Boise.
Can you teach it?
No.
Okay, can you?
I'm not to that point.
Okay, I understand.
It's wonderful. It's so earthy. Mm-hmm. It's like just going back to your roots.
Mm-hmm. I've done a bit of it.
Oh, it feels great.
It does feel, it's super athletic.
Which is
super athletic, which that's okay, because I can do it.
My heartbeat, you know, it was like, even if I wasn't doing the steps exactly right, my heart was beating and I was like so in it and I felt so good after doing it. So when I get caught up in perfection, I don't have so much fun.
What? Paul, that's like a pro tip for sure that I need to remember that one for sure, because isn't that the truth? Yeah. For stupid perfection, it's the worst.
It's a hold back.
It's pretty much the main thing that makes the humans crappy too. Yeah. is there anybody that lives in Boise that just doesn't do it anymore because we weren't encouraging them to do it?
Well, that's what I don't understand, because my teacher, my first teacher was Kim Bennett Porter, and oh my God, she's a beautiful dancer and mm-hmm. she does it all so well. Mm-hmm. And I know she's busy, she's got a family, so you know, I have
She's just afraid of being weird.
Maybe, I don't know. She was great, and she had it at the Jump Building in that dance, that movement room. Oh my God, it is gorgeous.
So then it wasn't too long ago.
It wasn't too long ago, and I think maybe it was about a year, maybe a year. She had live drummers. It was so fantastic. Well,
what the heck?
I know. And then recently, Flora, I think her last name is Flora Laguda. I hope I got that right. Started African dance, and it was in a smaller venue, and she didn't have live drummers, but who cares?
Not me.
Yeah. It was, in fact, I think I learned a lot more from that, I believe, because she was just learning also. You know, so she made mistakes, which I went, oh, thank you, because I make mistakes. You know, mistakes are absolute, they're necessary to learn anything.
But I think you're pointing also to an aspect of why people don't dance, because we have created this sense that dancing needs to be performed correctly.
Yeah, how sad is that?
Right?
Yeah.
So maybe, I don't know. Let's think and intend. The intention is already there, so I won't bother thinking until I have something relevant to think. But
I think your thinking is relevant.
Well, sometimes more than others, and right now I can vouch for it not being great. So So I know that you have an appointment with one of your many clients, and so I want to let you go, but please, please, please come back.
I would love to.
And again, the dates for your movement is October
12th. And the Monday night community meditation starts again in October 8th. It's on a Monday night. So the meditation is on Monday nights.
Mm-hmm.
It's short. It's kind of get in, meditate, and get out.
All right.
So we don't linger. I mean, you don't have to spend a lot of time. You know, a short meditation is powerful.
Heck yeah.
So, things start up again in October. And I'm excited about it. I'm really excited about it. And I have a few workshops under my belt now. So I'm really excited to continue to develop the curriculum and to share it with people.
Thank you. Okay, great. Well, I will be seeing you or hearing from you again soon.
Yay. Thank you. Thank you so much, Tracy.